This is the Hat Soil Health Podcast, a production of Hoosier Ag Today and the Conservation Cropping Systems Initiative, a program of the Indiana Conservation Partnership. In each episode, we spotlight the numerous efforts around the state by CCSI and its many partners to improve soil health on Indiana cropland. On this episode, we're talking strategies to incorporate new farms and fields into your soil health system. Here's your host, Elise Koning.
Hello, and welcome to the Hat Soil Health Podcast. Today we have Joe Hamilton on the episode. He's a farmer near Muncie. How are things going for you, Joe? Have you started harvest yet?
We have. We've ran a little bit of corn. It's hot and dry near Muncie. We haven't had any rain since August, and soybeans are turning yellow and starting to lose their leaves. We will probably be right in the middle of harvest in about 3 weeks.
Sounds good. We also have with us Andrew Burnzott, a farmer in the Connersville area. How are the crops looking your way?
Everything's looking good. There is quite a few of our neighbors running beans. We're actually going to go get started running some beans this afternoon. Corn is turning fairly quickly, losing pretty close to a point of moisture a day. So we, like Joe said, in about 3 weeks, we'll probably be about dead in the middle of it.
Nice. So Joe and Andrew have joined us to take a look at incorporating new farms or fields into a soil health system. There are plenty of things to do on the to-do list whenever we pick up a new farm or field. So we're going to talk about, what do you do first? Do you dive right in and do field work? Do you take a step back and take some soil tests? What's the strategy and what's the process for incorporating that farm or field? And so I want to start out hearing about your stories. Andrew, what's your background in farming and implementing a soil health system on your farm?
So I'll kind of start from the beginning. I'm a first-generation farm. I guess you could say that. My grandfather farmed, but he retired before I was old enough to have really worked with him. So he retired, but we still spent quite a bit of time together on the farm when I was young. I always loved being out there, so I was a farmhand for his tenant. After he retired for a couple years and kind of bounced around between farms, had a really good mentor that was a family friend throughout high school and my early college days. After that, I went to Purdue, graduated with a degree in ag econ and a minor in farm management. I then went to a farm south of Purdue there in Crawfordsville for about a year and a half, and then found Rulin Enterprises, as a lot of people that'll be listening to this podcast know. Worked for Rulins for a couple years, where I got really, really deeply ingrained in the soil health aspect of farming. Learned the basics all the way up to the really advanced practices. Got to meet some really great people, including Joe. And now I moved back to Connersville, Indiana, my hometown, and farm on my own, about 800 acres. Neat thing, I got to take over for one landowner that was retiring, is how I really got my start. And he had been long-term no-tills. He was about 35 years no-till before I started. So we're at almost 40 years of no-till on my main land base. Once I started, I implemented cover crops on 100% of the acres, and they were all multi-species on every single acre until last year. I think it was last year. I just got laid enough. I had to do some straight cereal rye. And then the other thing that I always like to do is and this is really learned from Rulins, is 1 acre grid soil sampling. Such a valuable tool on learning what's currently on the farm, looking at the footprint of the farm, really seeing yourself save quite a bit of money in inputs, just from over application and from making applications to a direct pinpoint spot that maybe a 2.5 or a 5 would have missed. But that's kind of the long-winded story about how I got started and where I am now.
Well, looking forward to learning more about how you implemented such a long-term system. Joe, what's your experience and what's your story?
So my story is I grew up in Delaware County, just south of Muncie, Indiana, and I grew up on the farm and left in 1998 to go to Purdue. I studied mechanical engineering. I went to a great ag school, and I didn't take a single ag class. And I left Purdue, and I was a mechanical engineer for 12 years. I lived in Detroit, Chicago, and Cincinnati. And in 2015, I decided to leave my cubicle and come back to the farm. When I came back to the farm, it was much like it was in the 90s when I left. It was a full tillage system, pretty much a conventional corn and soybean farm like most of my neighbors. And I saw a lot of struggles. I saw equipment problems, labor problems, high expenses, and I felt like that I could do better. And I set about making changes. The first was going to 100% no-till. The next was going to cover crops. And from that point in 2018, when we went no-till, 2019 to cover crops, I have dialed in my system. I use litter for most of my phosphorus needs now, and I have seen my soils and yields improve since making those changes.
So let's take a look at picking up those new farms or fields, what we do whenever you want to incorporate it into your soil health system. Where do you start? And I'll throw this out to both of you.
I'll go first. I think the way that I start with a new field is with soil samples. So I will go out and take baseline samples and see where the soil is. I pay special attention to calcium and magnesium base saturation. We have a lot of tight clay soils, and without enough calcium or with too much magnesium, the soils don't drain well. And I like to come in with a lime application initially with high-cal lime to get my calcium base saturation up to 68%. And once I achieve that, then I will usually come in with gypsum applications to bring my magnesium base saturation down to 12%. Using those soil tests, I like to apply poultry litter in the form of either chicken or turkey litter. I apply that on a variable rate grid and apply it anywhere that the phosphorus soil test levels are below 40 parts per million. I'll use potassium in the form of potash to bring up potassium levels up to 170 parts per million. And that's usually a good place to start. I also make sure that anything that I do right off the bat is includes a good cover crop mix that will overwinter into my first spring.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Joe said. I really like to start off a farm with soil samples. Like I'd mentioned before, we do some 1 acre grid soil sampling. So I'll go out and draw a boundary out with the Polaris and bring it back and upload it to SMS and lay out a grid. And then I share with Rulands a soil sampler, or I borrow from Rulands a soil sampler, and we pull all of our own soil samples. So I'll go out and pull 1 acre grids and take a look at what we're working with and what needs improved. And like Joe said, you know, starting with pH, looking at those calcium and magnesium levels. If we need to get gypsum on the farm, we try to get gypsum on the farm. And then along with, again, what Joe said too, we're using chicken litter on all ground going to corn. And then if we need to catch up on any K levels, we'll put out some potash as well. But really the biggest things I'm focusing on is trying to get my organic matters levels raised, my pH back in check, and then my calcium and magnesium levels back in check. And then the corn really loves the sulfur. So trying to balance all those things.
So we're talking about those nutrient levels and getting everything back in balance. Why is it so important to take a look at that first rather than just diving on in and working with the soil?
I think until you get your fundamental problems fixed in the form of chemical problems with your nutrient levels, it's going to make your soil health building journey take much longer. And if you're renting ground and paying paying competitive rents. You want to get your crop yields going as quick as possible. I don't think you can do that without fixing your nutrient levels right off the bat. And on top of that, especially with the calcium and magnesium, if you get better drainage and better aggregation, it will quickly help your soil health improve.
Yeah, exactly what Joe was saying. If you don't start with those fundamental principles of your, you know, your base soil, you know, you can add as much N, P, and K as you want, and you can still have deficiencies in your crop. You know, if your base saturations of calcium and magnesium exceed 90%, you're not going to readily accept potassium in the soil. You're just going to either have it sit on top or it's going to wash right through. So, like Joe said, getting those soils to those critical levels of where we're shooting for, you know, the 6.4 to 6.8 on pH, the 170 on K, the 40 parts per million on P, you know, highest CEC possible, highest OM possible, and then balancing out the calcium and magnesium. Until you get there, you don't really have a starting point.
So one thing I want to ask about is rented farms. Joe, you mentioned it can be harder to do things on rented farms sometimes just because you have a shorter term lease. How would you treat a rented farm versus one that has a longer term lease? And what are your short term versus long term goals?
I think in the whether it's rented ground or your own ground, you at least need to build your phosphorus up to 40 parts per million and your potassium up to 170. The only difference might be if it is ground that you have a long-term lease on versus a short-term or its own ground, you might consider building levels a little bit higher than that. But I think that even with a one-year lease, that should be your goal to hit those levels. One thing that we have done with one-year leases is if we are going to put 3 years of lime on, we will prorate that lime, that if either the tenant or the landlord ends the lease before the 3 years are up, the amount of remaining lime that you've added is prorated back to the farmer who paid for it. And that's a way that we have made it work, both for, I think it's fair to the landlord and the farmer to go ahead and fix the soil, but not put all the risk on the farmer of losing the farm.
I completely agree. We actually do the same thing between lime and chicken litter. We'll do 2 years on chicken litter, and we'll do 3 years on lime as well. But yeah, making sure that you're fixing that soil, even on the farms you may not keep for forever, because like we said, if you don't start from square one, you don't have much room to wiggle.
Right. So now that we've got all these nutrients in place, everything's in balance, what's the next step for your soil health system?
For me, the next step after you get your nutrients fixed is getting a good cover crop going. Keeping a living root in the soil all year is what's going to build soil health faster than anything else. And if it is going into soybeans, I like to get a good stand of cereal rye established right off the bat. If it's going to corn, I really prefer to do a mixture with annual ryegrass, some legumes and brassicas, and put that into standing soybeans the year before. That can be a challenge with a new farm if you don't get it until late into the fall. Worst case, I think I would still come in with cereal rye even before corn and try to terminate it a few weeks before the corn comes up. That way you would have a good cover crop established right off the bat.
I agree with what Joe said. We try to get a cover crop out as soon as possible, just to touch on what we're doing. Like I said, we did multi-species on every acre for my first 4 years, and then last year we had some straight cereal rye before soybeans. This year we have three different mixes and then a straight cereal rye that will go out right after the combine on some early harvested stuff, like the stuff we're gonna cut this afternoon. We'll probably try to shave some off and then put some cover crop down in the next couple days, and those are gonna include those are going to be more like oats, radishes, rape seeds, clovers, specifically S6 Rape, Bonanza Clover, and then some, I don't, the just tillage radishes. And then later, the later they go, we'll supplement in some cereal rye for the oats for the later mixes. And when we get so late, it'll just go to straight cereal rye. But getting that living root like out there, like Joe said, is so important for the soil. Not only the soil health. I mean, you're looking for infiltration rate. You're looking at soil structure. You're looking at tying up those nutrients that would, if that crop wasn't there, would, you know, then maybe leach through your soil and head out your tile. We're focused on keeping every dollar that we apply to that field there in that field so that we're able to utilize it.
There's a couple different directions I'm interested in, because I think that what you said about keeping every dollar on the field is really interesting. So can you dive more into that saying of how are you keeping those dollars on the field?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Indiana State Chemist says that if you have chicken litter applied, you either have to incorporate it or you can apply it to a living crop. The Indiana State Chemist will call a cover crop a living crop, which, you know, it is. It may not be harvested, but it's a living crop. So that's such a crucial asset for me, because then I can, you know, I can get a cover crop out in the fall and then get chicken litter out, whether it be, you know, due to availability and when they can get it applied. It could be in the next 3 weeks. It could be in the next 4 months. It's just depends on, you know, when we can get a spreader across the field. So being able to get that application out and then have that cover crop there to soak up those nutrients and hold on to them, rather than having to bring out a, say, a high speed disc or a vertical till to try to stir up the top to make the State Chemist happy. I'm able to not disturb the soil, let that cover crop soak up those nutrients and hold them until I'm ready to terminate the cover crop, and let that cover crop give back the nutrients to my now growing cash crop.
I agree. The quickest way to see money leave your field is to do tillage and watch the water carry it away. When you see muddy ditches, that's fertilizer and topsoil running away from your fields.
Yeah, one of the best things you can see in the spring is clean water coming off of the fields. And the other direction I wanted to go in was, since it is harvest time, people are starting to think about planting cover crops or have already planted cover crops. Can you speak to what your planting process is?
Sure. Our planting process behind corn is usually to go in with a no-till drill. And we use old John Deere 750 drills. They do a great job for putting down cereal rye or a mix. But we'll drill that right behind the combine and drill it about a half inch deep, put on 50 pounds per acre. And that cereal rye, a lot of times, will be up in 3 weeks. And by the time that January hits, you have 6 inches of cereal rye growth. Before corn, it's a little more complicated. We come in and broadcast a mix of legumes, grasses, brassicas in the standing soybeans. We usually try to do that by mid-September. We will be doing that this week with a drone for the first time on most of our soybean acres. And that mix is broadcast into the soybeans. Hopefully we get a little bit of rain and that cover crop takes off. As soon as we get the soybeans harvested, it will have a month of growth and get good establishment over winter and be collecting nutrients and building soil health up until the corn is planted.
I actually have a pretty interesting tool. Currently, I have a Phillips rotary harrow with a Valmar airbox on it that I've put cover crops on with last year. We're going to go ahead and do it again this year, unless I got my eyes on a John Deere 1850 drill that may be able to get. I'm not sure yet, but right now, that's the plan, is for this year to run the rotary Haro again. We'll go out, if I'm doing straight CRI, we're going with 45 pounds. And then most of the other blends come out about 35 pounds. And each blend is specifically blended to have some products that overwinter and have some that don't. Like I said, my earliest stuff has just oats, rape, rye, and clover in it. And the rapeseed, and actually the last couple winters we've had oats over winter. But that blend will have some overwinter in it. The next blend that we get into, once it gets a little bit later into the month of October, it will have, we'll split that oats in half and put cereal rye in with it. And have the cereal rye overwinter with the rapeseed, and get quite a bit of clover overwinter as well. And then we get on to just the straight cereal rye. So
you're listening to the Hat Soil Health Podcast, brought to you by the Conservation Cropping Systems Initiative, with farmers Joe Hamilton of Muncie and Andrew Bernzott of Connersville. So, Andrew and Joe, what are some of the challenges you faced in picking up a new farm or field and incorporating it into your soil health system?
The challenge is usually you pick up a field that has poor soil health to begin with, and you're not on a maintaining program, you're on a building program. And there can be a drag in the time that you make all these corrections and you switch to no-till and you start doing cover crops before you see the benefit of it. And you have to be a little bit patient and not give up on the first year if you don't see a great return right off the bat. I think that's the biggest challenge, and that's when I see people give up. It's usually because that they weren't patient enough to stick with it for more than 1 year.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Joe. Biggest issues are just staying economical in a build program like Joe's talking about. That's why I like the chicken litter program so much. If I know I'm going to have a farm for several years, I like to maintain a good relationship with the landlord so that, you know, the landlord doesn't want to rent someone else. We try to kind of stay away from farms that are just looking for the highest dollar every year. It's just not really the business model that I choose to go with, but, you know, maintaining that relationship with the landlord so that in that multi-year we can get the lime on and then see the results after, you know, you don't see the results from the lime for 2 to 3 years, and then potentially gypsum, chicken litter, seeing those results after a couple years. Like Joe said, you got to be persistent and stay with it. But, you know, I'm willing to rent the farms that the other guys don't really want to rent, because they might be the not so great farms. Because, you know, if you look a lot of the major universities, they'll tell you can't increase organic matter, and that you know, the only way to build nutrient values is to pour, you know, MAP or DAP and potash to it, and just build. But that it's, you know, with the price of fertilizer over the last several years, it's hard to stay economical when you're just trying to pour on as much as you can possibly pour on.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to ask related to those nutrients was about nutrient stratification. Joe, you had a presentation at this past year's no-till conference, and you talked a little bit about nutrient stratification and how you handle that. So will you give us a little bit of detail about what that challenge is and what you do to combat it?
Sure. Nutrient stratification has been a hot topic at the National No-Till Conference for the past few years. And I really wanted to see where my fields were. I was hoping that with the use of cover crops for several years and litter, that I had overcame a lot of those stratification problems. I had seen my yields increase. So last year, before the no-till conference, I went out and I took soil samples at 2-inch increments. And I analyzed those samples in a few different locations. And what I found was I still had quite a bit of stratification. Especially my calcium levels looked great in the first 2 inches. less great in the next two. And by the time I got to 4 to 6 inches, they were really lacking. They were closer to where that I started than where I'd like to be. And I didn't do any tillage when I made those major adjustments 5 years ago. And I think that if you are committed to no-till and you are going to make major amendment adjustments, you are going to have to deal with some stratification. And I think as you use cover crops and time goes on, you get better water infiltration and soil aggregation, and you stratification becomes less of an issue. But it is an issue right off the bat. And I think that anyone would be naive if they believe that you're going to overcome all the stratification challenges as soon as you make major changes.
Yeah, completely agree with Joe. I try to get cover crops out on the ground, like we talked about, as soon as possible. I'm trying to utilize some of the tuber cover crops, Essex rape, some of the finer root and deeper rooting cover crops. I don't do is annual rye. I'm just not a big fan of annual rye and trying to get rid of it and keep it out of everybody else's farms as well. But some of those cover crops, you know, if you do enough research and figure out which ones you really like, the one for me, like I said, is the Essex rapeseed. It really breaks up the compaction, opens up the soil profile, and lets those nutrients sink down into those lower channels, breaking up the stratification a little bit.
So as we start to wrap up our conversation, one thing I want to ask is about whenever you're talking to other farmers about a soil health system and you're talking with them about how to start, what advice would you give to a farmer who wants to incorporate new land into their soil health system and they're not quite sure where to start?
I think have reasonable expectations. If your expectation is to get all the money that you put into the ground back the first year, you're going to be disappointed. And I think that with reasonable expectations and patience, you can make a soil health system work in almost any farming scenario. That's my advice.
Completely agree. You're not probably going to see a big monetary return in your investment into the ground in year one, but it doesn't always have to. You know, there's things that you can put a dollar figure on if you'd like to, but that don't necessarily have a dollar figure to them that you'll see after year one. You know, I'm in year five, and really even after year one, I was seeing some of the benefits, and then in year, you know, every year since, they've just continued to grow, just in less, you know, less filling of ruts, hillsides that we farm becoming more profitable. And you know, things like that. Like Joe said, you know, don't expect to see dollar for dollar come back in year one, because this is such a long term game and a long term investment that hopefully you can stick it out and ride it out and see the benefits here in 5 to 10 years.
And don't get discouraged if you're not the first one planting, the first one harvesting, or have the best yields at the coffee shop. It's there's more to farming than that, and seeing your cover crop take off in the spring can be just as rewarding as getting out there and planting corn at the 1st of April.
Yes, absolutely. And Joe, I don't know if you have seen this or not, and I can't say that this is a direct correlation, but my crops seem to be staying greener substantially longer than a lot of the neighbors around me that aren't using any cover crops this year. I like to think, I don't have any way of proving this right off the bat, but I like to think it's from the water holding capacity we've gained from the cover crops on our ground, and not just dying out immediately.
I think you're right. I think that I'm seeing the same thing. Crops are staying greener longer, and they have better water holding capacity in the soil. They have roots that are going deeper, and they have better biology to support life long into the fall, even during a drought.
So it sounds like that this is a process that may take some patience, but the payoffs are worth it.
I agree.
Yes, absolutely.
So I would like to ask for your final thoughts. Let's start with Joe Hamilton. He's a farmer near Muncie. And what final thoughts would you like to share today?
I'd like to tell anyone who is thinking about getting into a soil health program to try it, to go out. And if you don't want to try it on all your acres, at least try it on a few. But do no-till, do cover crops, focus on fixing your soil and making some improvements and see if you can make it work for your system.
We also have Andrew Bernzott. He's a farmer near Connersville. Andrew, what are your final thoughts you'd like to leave us with today?
I agree with Joe. If you're interested in trying something with soil health, go out and try it. By no means do it on enough ground that's going to break the bank for you if something goes wrong, because in those first couple years of experiments, something's going to go wrong. I can almost guarantee it for you. But, you know, take a little five acre field that you've got, or a little, you know, 5 acre parcel in a field, or take 10 acres or 20 acres. Like I said, you know, something that's not going to break the bank for you, and try, you know, if you're a full tillage guy, try going to no-till. Try, if you're no-till already, try going to cover crops. Try, you know, tighter grid soil sampling. Try doing some chicken litter if you got a neighbor that does chicken litter. Don't be afraid to try something. And the biggest thing too is don't be afraid to reach out to something or to someone. We actually have just started a new program I was involved with. It's called farmadvisor.ag, where we have mentors around the state that will help you if you're interested in a soil health system. If you're interested in growing your soil health on your farm, you can sign up for this program, and you'll have a mentor that you can contact anytime to ask questions about real life scenarios. The stuff that we've been through will help you along the way. And if you, I'm more than welcome, or I'm more than happy to help with anybody if they've got any questions. I'm sure Joe is as well. There's tons and tons of us out here, and most of us are all willing to lend a helping hand if somebody's got a question, if they're trying something new.
I am always available to help people, and I learned from a lot of mistakes that other people had made before I had to make them myself, and I would like to extend the favor to other people who are trying new things as well.
If you'd like to learn more about that Farm Advisor program, our last episode of the Hat Soil Health podcast talked with some of the founders and mentors of Farm Advisor, so you can go back and check out that August 2024 episode. Andrew, thanks so much for sharing your insight with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
And Joe, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
This has been the Hat Soil Health Podcast. I'm your host, Elise Koning.
This episode of the Hat Soil Health Podcast has been brought to you by the Conservation Cropping Systems Initiative. You can learn more about their efforts and see a schedule of events at ccsin.org. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, create your riches below the surface with healthy soil. This has been a production of Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.